Done.
96 1-800 900-9596.
This is Money Clip on Bloomberg Television. We are fully digital. Download our BTV Plus app. It's free. I'm Adam Johnson. All right, today's moving pictures now where the video is the story. We begin with a seventh day of massive demonstrations in Hong Kong. Hundreds of protesters crowded in front of the government headquarters. Many wore face masks and goggles as they demanded democratic elections. Now, the protesters remained calmed as police carried in boxes of equipment, including some that were actually labeled rubber batons. At the same time, the city's leader said he won't resign, but he is willing to discuss constitutional reforms. As for the protesters, they say they are also open to negotiations. And government officials have released video of rescue efforts following this weekend's eruption of a volcano in central Japan. Teams of firefighters are seen cautiously navigating steep slopes, carrying injured people on stretchers. The rescue workers wore surgical masks and goggles as smoke and ash continued to spew from the mountain. Incredible images. At least 47 people were killed and 70 injured by this unexpected and sudden eruption. And how's this for art? It's a 6-acre portrait of a young man's face, which has emerged on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Cuban-American artist Jorge Rodriguez Aranda created the piece. He calls it, out of many, one. He says his artwork is a celebration of America's diversity. More than 100 people in Dallas are being monitored for symptoms of Ebola after coming into contact with patient Thomas Eric Duncan. You may recall he's the passenger who flew in from Liberia and then later complained of symptoms and was ultimately diagnosed. This was about a few days ago. Officials ordered four of Duncan's family members to remain at home until at least October 19th. They are not allowed to have any visitors. Now, concern about the spreading or possible spreading of the disease, it's very real. Turns out this man's journey back to the U.S. from Liberia spanned four airports and three continents, though the CDC, does say that he was not contagious while traveling because he did not show any symptoms at that point. Here's Bloomberg's Shelby Holliday.
Many times it's only transmitted via bodily fluids, but given this news, I was starting to reach out to see how airlines are prepared to handle more infected passengers, if they're prepared to handle infected planes, and the responses I got were pretty alarming. The Federal Aviation Administration says the FAA does not have rules on decontaminating planes. An airline would consult the CDC on that. CDC told me I would suggest speaking with an airline, and when I talk to airlines, they say they're complying with CDC guidelines. So it appears that there are no official rules, no official oversight when it comes to decontaminating planes and sanitizing airplanes for passengers. The CDC does have guidelines, and it does tell airlines to follow these certain rules. They recommend using protective gear, washing hands, treating bodily fluids as infectious. Those are kind of no-brainers here. And the airlines are telling me that they do have procedures in place and safety is a priority. But again, there's no official oversight. It appears there are no rules.
Have the airlines on which this man flew contacted all of the other passengers to just make them aware that they were on that flight?
That is unclear at this point. We do know it was a United plane coming from Brussels to Washington, D.C., and then Washington, D.C. to Dallas. We have not spoken to passengers yet. The CDC was trying to focus on the symptoms in Dallas and the people he was in contact with in Dallas.
Yeah, imagine being on that flight. That's a little scary. Several aid workers who have fallen ill have been flown to the U.S., the U.K., Spain, and France. That was obviously a very controlled situation. All right, 0 to 60 in 4 seconds. Talk about control. Mercedes, it's got the new two-seat Roadster. It's debuting at the Paris Auto Show. We'll take you there and interview the CEO. Plus, it's one of the most controversial drugs a doctor can prescribe, medical marijuana. But one Israeli startup actually wants to change that, believe it or not, by taking out the high. That's coming up in innovation. And as we head to break, Russian President Vladimir Putin is ruling out the use of capital controls to slow the accelerating flow of money out of Russia. Speculation the government was going to do that had actually sent the Russian ruble to a record low.
Yeah, girl. You know, I've been thinking about us. I just can't fight it anymore. It's bundle time. Feel those savings, baby.
And that's how a home and auto bundle is made. Better he learns it here than on the streets.
The miracle of bundling. Now that's progressive.
If you've ever stripped a screw or broken off the head of a bolt, you know how frustrating that can be. Well, not anymore. Introducing the Speedout Damaged Screw and Bolt Remover. With the Speedout, you can easily remove any stripped screw in 10 seconds or less. You'll never again be slowed down or frustrated by a stripped screw or broken bolt. Phillips heads, flatheads, hex heads, painted overheads. The Speedout gets them all out in 10 seconds or less. The Speedout is a must-have for do-it-yourself. Selfers, boat owners, hobbyists, mechanics, carpenters, or anyone else. The Speedout is quick and easy to use. If you can use a drill, you can use the Speedout. You simply drill out the damaged area with a patented cutting end. Then you flip the tool around, and the extracting end pulls it right out. It's that simple. It's that easy. Notice that the cutting end makes a perfect cone into the screw. This makes an ideal surface for the extracting end to grab onto. In fact, this patented process works so well, you can even remove 4-inch long stubborn deck screws out of redwood. Even if you break off the entire head of a screw or bolt, you can still extract it right out. No problem. The Speedout is a must for every toolkit. No more headaches or wasted time. And best yet, the Speedout is affordable. For a limited time, you can get the entire Speedout 4-piece kit for just $19.95. Call now, and you'll get 4 different sizes of Speedout extractors for every situation. Don't wait until the next time you strip a screw or break a bolt. Call right now, because sooner or later, you're going to need a Speedout. And to make this offer even better, we're going to give you free shipping. You heard right. Free shipping for everyone who calls right now. And as an added bonus, we'll also throw in a lifetime warranty. If it ever breaks, we'll replace it, no problem. Call or log on to the website and get your Speedout right now. It'll be the best $20 you ever put in your toolbox.
When everything's included, the kids get a vacation of their own, and so do we. But when we get together, it's the best time of all. I can feel it, yeah. Right now, you can get up to 65% off. Call your travel agent or 1-800-BEACHES.
The Paris Auto Show kicks off today. Our international correspondent Hans Nichols actually got to make the trip, and he spoke with several key executives, including Ford CEO Mark Fields. Now, on the heels of Ford's announcement earlier this week, it'll lose $1.2 billion in Europe this year. Hans began the interview with, when will profits return?
Well, we gave guidance on Monday through 2015, and, you know, clearly as we look at Europe, we do expect to improve next year pretty significantly, but still at a loss. And really that's around the deterioration we've seen in Russia. Also the market, although it's been recovering, it's a little bit of weakness the last couple of months, so, you know, we've had to adjust our expectations. And then finally we've had, with the low interest rates, an impact on our pension plans. But our expectation is to get back to profit as soon as possible.
Okay, so that's 2016, or you're...
We have not given any guidance beyond 2015.
Well, walk me through your situation in Russia right now. You obviously have a joint venture there.
Yes.
You're with Sollers. Where are you with that? And is that long-term feasible?
Well, absolutely. We've got a great partner in Sollers. And when you look at the Russian market, even at its depressed level right now, it's still as big as the UK, for example. So our view is that it somewhere down the road, it will be the largest market in Europe. And we've been investing. We've started 2 years ago with only producing 2 products. By the end of next year, we'll produce 11. And we want to serve that Russian customers. It's a big, important market, but clearly we're looking at the situation.
When you talk about the situation, though, what's your timeline? Are we talking a year, 2 years? When do you think it really comes back?
Well, again, we take the long view. We continue to expect 2015 to be a tough year in terms of growth there. Hopefully, starting in 2016, we'll start seeing a growth come back to the marketplace. But again, we take the long view, and we're investing through the cycle.
Okay. long view in Europe as well, capacity is obviously, at least, you know, it's shrunk.
Yes.
Does more need to be done to cut back capacity? Is it never going to get back to pre-crisis levels?
Well, from our point of view and our plan, you know, our plan is all about introducing great product.
So does that mean we're in a fight for market share then? Is that what this comes down to? The same amount of customers, but we're fighting for market share?
Well, I think you'll see growth. It's the market here is the lowest it's been in 6 years. Will we see pre-crisis levels? Well, when you look at the economics, you look at some of the things around that, we expect some growth, but probably not getting back to pre-crisis level anytime soon. And we've adjusted our plans accordingly. But it all comes back to making sure you have compelling product to grow your slice of the pie, and that's our intention.
Okay, so the Russian market is bad, as Fields mentioned. Here's what some of the other automakers had to say about Russia.
The Russian market is down 20% this year. And frankly, we don't see a recovery next year, which means it's going to stay down for a while until the environment around Russia gets more stable. But we are increasing market share. So the question of market share is not the issue. And we are increasing market share because, obviously, as you know, the ruble is weakening, which gives an advantage to all those who are localized in Russia. And we are the most localized in Russia. So in a certain way, this crisis helps our market position.
Of course, the nervous thing is will this influence the whole development in Europe? That would be the big risk.
We've had good sales in Russia over the last few years. We had over 40,000 last year. The first 6 months of the year were where we expected them to be, you know, a little bit of growth. The last couple of months, yes, we've seen it slowing somewhat. And, you know, I think the issues in the economy are really the heart of that. But, you know, we see Russia as a market for the future.
We have many things to do to improve our business model, indeed in Russia and Latin America, because we are still in the red in those areas. But what we can see also is that all the actions that we have taken within the framework of this Back in the Base plan, we are now also getting results on those regions. It's not yet in the black, but the amount of red is getting smaller and smaller.
We are looking forward to do a good business in Russia, but obviously we are well prepared all over the world, so we are able to fix some figures with other markets.
Okay, also at the Paris Auto Show, Mercedes CEO Dieter Zetsche. He joined us this morning on surveillance, and I asked him if he's looking to China and the U.S. for growth rather than Europe and obviously Russia.
As far as the markets are concerned, you're absolutely right. When we talk about our sales, we are basically growing everywhere. So, for instance, in Europe, where the market is pretty slow, last month we were growing another 16%. That's based on strong product and great demand. We are defined by our capacity. We could sell more if we could produce more.
You have an E-Class, an S-Class, an M-Class, a G-Class. I mean, you got so many different classes and different cars within the classes. Are you trying to basically segment the market so that no matter who you are, you can find a Mercedes? It's right. Is that the goal here?
I think that is a typical development of all kind of consumer markets, that you get this kind of fragmentation. If you don't offer it, the competitor will. So yes, we have more and more variety in our portfolio, but at the same time, we do that with our system in our production, in our development, which is modular and allows us to handle this complexity and satisfy all customer needs.
What's the risk, though, that in offering all those different models and all those different price points, you effectively dilute the brand?
Well, we think the opposite is true. On the one hand, with the new compact cars like the CLA in the U.S., we are having 80% conquest rate, which is kind of unheard of. New, younger customers are coming to us. At the same time, the new S-Class is considered as the best car in the world by many people. And this combination gives us more momentum, more dynamics into our brand. And the S-Class buyer likes the younger brand, and the young guy likes when we are building the best car in the world.
Yeah, well, that new GT is hot. Can you tell me how much that costs, by the way? I'm trying to figure out if I can afford it.
It'll be around 100,000 euro here, and similarly in the U.S. in dollars. So it's very close to its perhaps direct competitor, the Porsche 911.
Oh, that's very key. Just before I say goodbye, in other words, 100,000 euros and $100,000, somewhere in there, there's an exchange rate of about 30%. So are you making less on the one that you sell in the U.S.?
No, strange enough not. In spite of mathematics, the point is that our portfolio is stronger in the U.S. So we, for instance, sell more 8-cylinders of S-classes versus more 4 and 6-cylinders in Germany. And then in the mix, we have similar contributions. Actually, we are more profitable in the U.S. than we are in Germany.
All right, we will bring you more from the Paris Auto Show tomorrow, including a look at that particular car. That is the new Rolls-Royce Phantom. That is a monster.
Do you get the financial advice you truly need?
We're facing major college costs.
I saved the money. Now I need to make it work.
Getting the financial advice you need shouldn't depend on who you are or where you are in life. At Edelman Financial, we believe everyone deserves great financial advice, even if you're not rich.
You've seen Rick on TV, heard him on the radio, and read his best-selling books. Now, put Edelman Financial to work for you. Go online to learn more or call us now.
The first thing we'll do is talk. Actually, you'll do the talking. We'll listen. Next, we make a plan for you, and then you can relax, knowing we're always here for you. Call now for your free portfolio review.
I want smart advice in plain English.
I want a plan to help me get where I want to go.
That's why I'm going to Edelman Financial.
Edelman Financial, because everyone deserves great financial advice.
Call 1-800-691-5413.
Can a polo build your brand? At Lands' End Business Outfitters, we help build brands by combining quality clothing, expert embroidery, and legendary service. For 20 years, we've created brand right looks for thousands of businesses just like yours. And when you're wearing your logo, you're building your brand. Customers recognize it. Employees take pride in it. Your image improves with it. Your brand grows with us.
Eliminate your monthly phone bill with Magic Jack. Compare, then make the switch. Don't be fooled by Vonage and Basic Talk deals. Get unlimited local and long-distance calling to the U.S. and Canada for just $35 per year. Click or visit Radio Shack today.
So you're talking about a show that's kind of like what we did in our books.
Exactly. The high human drama of politics. And politics is fun.
But the show should be about more than politics. About politics and sports and entertainment and culture. The whole thing.
Exactly. It's like a taco bar and a sushi bar all in one.
That sounds pretty good.
This is Money Clip on Bloomberg Television. We are streaming live everywhere, including on your Windows device. I'm Adam Johnson. Well, the U.S. government has a secret lab. It's called Skunk Works. Silicon Valley has its own version. It's called Google X. It's home of the driverless car and Google Glass. Emily Chang spoke with a man who ran it, and she joins us now with a preview. Emily, is this guy mad scientist or just clever businessman?
You know, I think he's more mad scientist. He likes to be known as the godfather of artificial intelligence. Sebastian Thrun, known for doing so much in AI and robotics, and also the inventor of the self-driving car. But one thing that I learned in my interview with him is that he had to be convinced to do this thing. And the person who convinced him was Larry Page, co-founder of Google. Take a listen.
So then at what point did Larry and Sergey say, hey, we also want to do self-driving cars, and you know something about that?
Larry really came to me and said, look, it's time to do something kind of courageous that's really out there, a moonshot. And he actually, he had to convince me. He said, look, build a car that can drive itself, it's safer than humans. So I said, it's hard, Larry. And said, well, it's not that hard. Have you tried? And I said, I haven't really tried because I know it's hard. And then Larry said, well, give it a try. I said, okay. All right, don't blame me if I screw it up, but I'm going to give it a try.
You helped found Google X. the Moonshot Factory. How did that come about?
I drank the Kool-Aid. Like, I was at the point where I'd say, do away all the skepticism, just do it and see what happens. And so it turns out the Google leadership, Sergey and Larry and Eric, kind of the same personality. So they said, absolutely yes.
Google Glass was the first project within Google X. Then they've done the medical contact lenses, broadband balloons floating around the world that will connect us via internet, and so much more. We learned a lot of fascinating things, Adam, about Google X and what else they're working on.
Yeah, pretty amazing stuff. Okay, thanks, Emily. You can watch Emily's full interview with Sebastian Thrun. That is coming up on Studio 1.0 tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific. Okay, today in innovation, medical marijuana. It alleviates pain, but it also makes you high. No kidding. Doctors don't necessarily approve of that detail. Turns out, nor does the government. So one lab in Israel is working on a solution with the help of a 3D printer. It's the pot puffer.
In a Tel Aviv drug lab, medical marijuana is getting a makeover. Ground and filtered, it's destined for a new 3D printed pot puffing device that won't get you high.
We've developed the first meter dose cannabis inhaler, which allows 100 microgram resolution. All this while using the raw cannabis without any chemical alterations or additives, which allows us to penetrate existing regulatory systems today.
So no expensive clinical trials, no more guessing how much cannabis a patient needs to relieve their pain. The devices they're making here in Psyche's lab are destined for Israeli hospitals, but they hope the real money spinner will be this. It's a cannabis inhaler for home use. They hope to have it in Israeli homes next year and into the all-important American market the year after. That market, already worth about $1.4 billion, could rise to more than $10 billion by 2018. Psyche hopes to win about 2% of that, or some $200 million. But does the inhaler actually work? David Meir, a former Navy SEAL injured in Lebanon, was one of 10 Israeli patients to trial it.
I'd spend whatever it takes to have this device. It doesn't show everyone else how much I'm suffering or what I'm using. It lets me decide how to take care of my health and be much more relaxed on the outside.
The doctor overseeing the Psyche trial says the device could change marijuana's image.
Doctors were reluctant to prescribe cannabis as is, as cigarettes, because of the stigma, because of the actually you need to smoke for that. I think that from now on, once approved, everybody is going to look at it as a medicine, as opposed to a substance that people use.
With approval in Israel imminent, Psyche aims to raise up to $20 million to boost production of its device. If all goes well, it plans to apply its technology to other controlled substances, such as opium.
Okay, today's loose change, climbing an industrial chimney. Without safety equipment, not most people's idea of fun, but for a group of Czechs, it's a hobby.
Your customers, our financing. Your aspirations, our analytics. Your goals, our technology. Introducing Synchrony Financial, bringing new meaning to the word partnership. Banking, loyalty, analytics. Synchrony Financial. Engage with us.
Here's big news for small business. Could your business use from $5,000 to $250,000? Introducing LendVantage, a free service that connects small business to big capital. Go online, complete a simple application, and you could get pre-approved for up to $250,000 in minutes. And you get the money in as fast as one business day after approval. LendVantage, lending small business a big advantage. Go to LendVantage.com or call 1-800-999-LEND.
Single Christians, good news. ChristianMingle.com has over 13 million registered members. Nearly 4 million new members in the past year alone. Every day, members send more than 200,000 messages. I sent one of those messages and met my beautiful wife. That's good news. Join today and find God's match for you. Sometimes we wait for God to make the next move when God is saying it's your time to act. The next move is yours. Joining is easy and free. Join ChristianMingle.com today.
Will you help us find a new house for you and your brother? Store, they don't come up to you and say, hey, I'd like to go out on a date. But on our time, they do.
It was really nice to be on a site where gentlemen are actually looking for someone of my age.
And then they match you up with somebody that has the same likes and the same values.
I feel like I'm back in high school.
I got my first flirt within about 10 minutes of being on the site. Yeah.
Ourtime.com. Visit today and get started for free.
It's time now for Bloomberg Television on the Markets. I'm Julie Hyman. Let's take a look at where stocks traded today. All over the place, in a word. We had jobless claims this morning unexpectedly falling, defying economists' predictions. Continuing claims, meanwhile, at an eight-year low. Of course, we have the jobs report tomorrow. A lot of traders positioning themselves ahead of that. Enormous range over the course of the session, both upwards and downwards. I do want to bring you some breaking news coming from J.P. Morgan. The New York Times reporting earlier today that the bank had found more evidence related to its security breach earlier this year. Now the bank is saying that that data breach has affected 76 million households and 7 million business customers. J.P. Morgan says it's continuing to investigate that matter and vigilantly monitor the situation as well. It says that user contact information and internal J.P. Morgan information on users was compromised. However, the bank says it continues not to have seen really any unusual activity that has been linked to that. There's no evidence at the same time that account information was compromised. All of this, by the way, coming in a filing from J.P. Morgan. We'll continue to monitor that and bring it to you as we do get more information. But in the meantime, I want to bring you back to the markets and what we saw from the Russell 2000 today, because we've been watching this index of small caps closely. It had entered a correction, that is a fall of 10% from its highs, but today we saw a rebound here as perhaps some investors judge that drop overdone and came back in and did some buying. And in terms of what happens next, Adam Johnson took a look at the market's wild swings earlier today when we were at session lows. Here's his insight and action.
Yeah, the one question every equity investor is trying to answer today, is it safe to step in and buy? Let's talk about it on Insight in Action. First of all, we have been here before. The current decline that we are seeing of about 4% versus the high from a few weeks ago, actually, to put that in context, that is very similar to other declines we've seen so far this year. There have been three notable declines this year. In August, 3.8%, April, 3.9%, and January, 5.7%. So we're starting to get there. All right. I found actually three technical indicators that might also give you a little bit of comfort. And here they are. When momentum breaks down, stocks tend to rally. In other words, what we did is we showed the S&P 500 in white. There's that trend that we've seen so far over the past year versus the percentage of stocks in the S&P 500 that are still above the 20-day moving average. Well, not many. Only about 12% are above. And typically what we have seen is that when you have these sudden sell-offs, that stocks then tend to rally. There was another one. So here we are down here. It may suggest that the selling has exhausted itself, and in theory, maybe we get a rebound. That's, again, what we've seen in previous occasions. Here's another one. When panic rises, stocks tend to rally. The put-call ratio was very high yesterday, second highest that we've seen this year. And as it turns out, when a lot of people go in to buy puts, you also tend to get rallies. In other words, everybody's scared, but when everybody's scared, then the path of least resistance is up. And finally, one really clever chart I want to show you from the team over at Strategus Research. Remember, it's a midterm election year, and since 1950, when midterms happen, stocks rally. Here's been the pattern for the midterm election years since 1950. Stocks rally in October, November, and December. So it's a little scary to go in and buy, but there are three indicators that might make you feel a little bit more comfortable.
And, of course, also in our earlier discussion with Paul Hickey of Bespoke Investment Group, he talked about this increase in volatility. We may end the month higher, but it may be a rough ride to get there. For On the Markets, I'm Julie Hyman.
What does Silicon Valley get that other industries don't yet?
Bloomberg's Emily Chang sits down with the biggest influencers in technology and media.
Honestly, in the beginning, we were not trying to make money.
It was all an experiment.
You think that you may live to 120.
I certainly hope to, yes.
I'm a little paranoid of not being needed and wanted, I guess.
For candid conversations about how they made it and where they're going next, Studio 1.0, tonight at 9 on Bloomberg Television.
Siri, play.
TLX from Acura.
When folks think about what they get from Alaska, they think salmon and energy. But the energy BP produces up here creates something else as well. Jobs all over America. Engineering and innovation jobs, advanced safety systems and technology, shipping and manufacturing. Across the United States, BP supports more than 250,000 jobs. When we set up operation in one part of the country, people in other parts go to work. That's not a coincidence. It's one more part of our commitment to America.
Yo, bro, you on Woo Woo? You kidding me? Everybody's on Woo Woo.
Woo Woo.
Lock and load, people.
We're going all in on Woo Woo.
Mark, comp us up a profile page.
Susie, write us some posts.
I want sponsored woos. I want targeted woos.
We need an ethnically ambiguous Woo Woo mascot.
Dude, are you still on Woo Woo?
Nah, man. My mom's on Woo Woo.
In New York City, this is Charlie Rose.
Good evening. I'm Ian Bremmer, filling in for Charlie Rose, who's on assignment. Demonstrators are protesting what they see as China's attempts to strangle democracy in Hong Kong. The protesters were initially met by a harsh police crackdown. The standoff continues today as student leaders call for the resignation of Hong Kong's chief executive, C.Y. Leung. Joining me from Washington is John Huntsman. He served as the U.S. ambassador to China from 2009 to 2011 and is a former candidate for the Republican presidential nomination in 2012. I'm pleased to have him with me on this program. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be with you.
So let's just start by telling us where we are right now in this dispute. How dangerous is it and how has it played out in your view?
Well, I think on the ground, we clearly have a standoff, and I think that's likely to last some time, which probably accommodates the needs of both sides. It accommodates the needs of Beijing because they can't be seen as cracking down or doing anything drastic anytime soon. And it certainly accommodates the demonstrators and the freedom seekers in Hong Kong because, listen, Hong Kong is just a freewheeling place, and this is the way they do business. So I suspect that the short-term prognosis is they'll likely remain as they are, tens of thousands, maybe reaching 100,000 people in the financial district of Hong Kong. And the dynamic in Beijing will be an interesting one, Ian, because what I think it's reflective of is Xi Jinping's personalized leadership style, which is far different than anyone we've seen since Deng Xiaoping. So whatever happens out of Beijing and the choices he makes will very much be reflective of him and his experiences and his leadership style, as opposed to any kind of collective approach to problem solving that we saw, for example, under the term of Jiang Zemin, or certainly more recently under Hu Jintao. They didn't nearly have the personalized approach nor the political power base that Xi Jinping has. So they had to broker deals within, for example, the Standing Committee of the Politburo, particularly as it related to Hong Kong. So as you remember, some of the issues that played out under the reign of Jiang Zemin or Hu Jintao, and I cite 2003 specifically, they were fairly successful in terms of their ability to kind of settle things out. But this is a different player, Xi Jinping, and this is all playing out in a much different dynamic, given the high politics that exist in Beijing, particularly driven by this whole anti-corruption program.
Has he made a mistake? Has he overplayed his hands? I mean, you were in Hong Kong right after they put out that white paper that changed the nature of suffrage in the upcoming election. It's clearly on him to a degree. Did he go too far?
Well, we're going to know that in the days and weeks ahead. How he responds to this will say everything about how he chooses to deal with Hong Kong going forward. And suffice it to say, you know, Hong Kong, as opposed to the, you know, one country, two systems approach that Deng Xiaoping so artfully and creatively designed with Margaret Thatcher as they were developing the basic law back in the 80s and 90s, is looking more like one country as opposed to two systems, one country. But what is inside Xi Jinping's head as all of this plays out? You have to remember that, you know, Xi Jinping has a much different relationship with Hong Kong than his predecessors did. So he was the party secretary running Shanghai not so long ago, Shanghai being a major economic competitor with Hong Kong. So he saw Hong Kong very much as a rival and probably full of troublemakers and hooligans for the most part. And then you dig a generation deeper than that, and Xi Jinping's father, Xi Zhongxun, as the story goes, was responsible for Hong Kong under Mao Zedong. And that's when the British and other Western powers were running fairly subversive operations out of Hong Kong into the mainland. So there was indeed a black hand behind all things in Hong Kong back in those days, as seen by Beijing. And so I suspect that Xi Jinping, based upon even his early formative years, still probably sees Hong Kong as full of some Western troublemakers who ultimately are behind a lot of this.
Back in 1997, during the handover, Hong Kong was, I think, 16% of China's GDP. It's tiny now. Even if there needs to be a crackdown, are those steps that he is less concerned about taking because it just doesn't matter as much to China's future?
Well, you have the domestic component in China and then the regional component and certainly the global component. They're all important. But as he sees it, certainly in 97 during the handover, Hong Kong was, in fact, the goose laying the golden eggs economically for China. Today, I suspect that Xi Jinping and many of the leaders in Beijing probably see Hong Kong increasingly as just another big Chinese city with none of the unique economic characteristics that made it so different. Some years ago. And there has traditionally been a rivalry between Shanghai and Hong Kong, rivalry in terms of attracting investment, in terms of locating corporate headquarters, the advancement of economic development. Hong Kong has always maintained its connection to that bulwark of rule of law and that which is really created that economic and political uniqueness over at least the last 150 years. But increasingly, it's seen as just another big city in China. And sadly, I think that may be the way in which some of the decision makers proceed as they view their options going forward.
Now, that's the way that Xi Jinping sees it. But is that the way the Chinese people see it? I mean, I'm wondering, Shanghai's gotten a lot wealthier over the past years. You'd hear people saying that Hong Kong, a bunch of spoiled children, they don't know how good they have it. They're always complaining. But now you have a lot of mainland Chinese that themselves are quite wealthy. They've spent a lot of time there. They have their own aspirations. Is it possible that Xi is out of touch with a fair amount of his population, his own domestic population on this issue?
I think Xi is, for the most part, in touch. He gets around. He's been sort of a populist leader for the most part. And I have to tell you that he's fairly popular and well thought of domestically. So if ever there was a Chinese leader who actually had some leverage among his own population to be able to work out some sort of approach in settling down Hong Kong, he would certainly be a leader to be able to do that. He's fully consolidated power over his last 2 years of leadership. He has a direct shot to the 19th Party Congress, which will be in about 3 years, and then he'll be around another 5 years after that. But here's another complicating factor, Ian, about the timing of this whole thing, because we've got LegCo elections and the whole reform discussion will play into 2017. And if this whole universal suffrage model isn't clearly defined beyond what we understand it to be today, then the next opening is going to be 5 years later, which takes us to 2022. Well, what's playing out in 2022 in Beijing? You've got the 20th Party Congress and the real change of leadership, where Xi Jinping will be stepping down and somebody else will be stepping into the primary role there. And we all know that during those leadership transitions, nothing gets done. There's a hyper-cautious environment that people step into. And if the universal suffrage rules of the road can't be defined sometime fairly soon, I think we're in a long waiting game that could create more in the way of citizen turnout, both in Hong Kong, the anxiety associated with the lack of understanding with respect to the original commitment. And then you've got the whole Taiwan dimension, which is a very, very important aspect of the story, little reported and commented on. But you have elections there in 2016. You've got municipal elections next year, and then, of course, presidential elections in 2016. And how this plays out will have enormous implications for presidential politics in Taiwan.
But you don't see particular sympathies among the mainland Chinese population for the Occupy Hong Kong movement as it stands right now.
You will certainly have pockets of those who are sympathetic, particularly among the young people. But there more recently has been a fairly deep wave of nationalism throughout China. Xi Jinping has again consolidated power. He's solidified himself as a singular leader in the tradition of Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping. And he has broad-based support. But you will have pockets of the population, and I would say increasingly among the young people who kind of see the world through similar terms, who would be more sympathetic to what's happening in Hong Kong. And so, the more this is sort of left to chance without any definition put around it, you'll probably have more in the way of sympathizers.
So does that give Xi Jinping more flexibility, in your view, if he acts decisively one way or the other now? In other words, if he decides to crack down, or if he decides that there's going to be some form of compromise, maybe forces the chief minister to actually step down?
Well, he doesn't have a lot of margin for error here. One, they've got a chief executive in Hong Kong, in Mr. Leung, who was not popular. He's seen as being in the hip pocket of Beijing. He is not widely liked and respected by the people of Hong Kong. So to have him as the intermediary is negotiating with one hand tied behind your back, so to speak. And then beyond that, the high politics that are playing out in China for Xi Jinping make it so that he doesn't have margin for error. So they've got this anti-corruption campaign playing out. He's making a lot of enemies as he takes down some of these fairly senior leaders. You know, he calls it, you know, the tigers. He's taking out tigers and flies. Well, the tigers that he's taking out, people like Zhou Yongkang, who was at one point the most powerful man in China, responsible for the security apparatus, and military leaders like Xu Caiho. Well, these people have their own political networks, and you better believe that they're going to gun for Xi Jinping at every opening. And if she makes a bad call here, and if things don't go his way, that could escalate in terms of anti-Xi sentiment, at least among the political elite within China, pretty quickly. And I'm sure he knows that. And so he's going to be very careful in terms of the choices that he considers for Hong Kong.
Is that going to make him more reluctant if things get bad to call on the PLA? Because at the end of the day, does he not want to be beholden to that group for favors or give them power in the resolution of the Hong Kong crisis?
Calling in the PLA or to take drastic action would be disastrous. It would be disastrous for the public image of China, which I know down deep they very much care about. It would be disastrous in terms of some corners of the party who are more reform-minded and oriented. It would be a disaster in terms of the very survival and well-being economically of Hong Kong, because increasingly, even just as this plays out, with just tear gas and umbrellas at this point. You know, corporations are going to begin to vote with their feet. And at least what I'm hearing, people reconsidering Hong Kong as a regional headquarters, already packing up their bags and moving to places like Singapore. This could be very real. And the worst nightmare scenario for Xi Jinping is to see capital flight out of Hong Kong and China. That they can't afford to see happen, which I would put as being just as painful as any of the implications that might result from any kind of harsh crackdown.
So he's clearly very constrained in this environment. Look at it from the Hong Kong reformist perspective as well. We do have demands now from the leadership, such as it is in the Occupy Central movement, that if CY Lung does not step down by the end of the day tomorrow, they are going to occupy government buildings. Do you believe that Xi Jinping can stand aside and not require a harsh crackdown if they actually follow through on that?
I can think, I suspect he can let it play out to a certain extent, but at some point there's going to have to be some compromise. There's going to have to be some brokered settlement that is somewhere between, you know, a one person, one vote, which is ultimately what everyone thought would be the outcome, and one committee, one outcome, which is kind of what came out in the white paper in June. They just changed the rules fundamentally. So somebody's going to have to open up the negotiation with the primary, the principal players in Hong Kong, and strike some sort of compromise. I don't know yet what that will be, but it's going to have to be something along the lines of how you broaden the pool of candidates that will then be allowed to stand up for a vote. Do you allow candidates, for example, if they can reach a certain number of signatures by key constituencies within Hong Kong? Will you take the 1,200 delegates, so to speak, who are responsible for vetting the handful of candidates? And in the white paper, it also came out that the criteria for running are you patriotic and do you love China? That's the language that was used. And so ultimately, Beijing really does have the upper hand in terms of choosing whatever that slate of candidate happens to be. So the key will be how you open up the slate and how you allow more fresh air in and maybe more diverse voices. That's not an easy thing to do, but I suspect that that's about the only choice ahead other than some sort of harsh crackdown, which would be a disastrous thing for China, for the region, and I think for the global economy.
One of the things that's sort of bolstered Xi's charisma internally in China has been all this talk of a Chinese dream, very different from his views of an American dream. And I guess what I want to ask you is, can there be one Chinese dream that encompasses the aspirations of Hong Kong? Do you think he believes there can, and do you believe there can?
Well, the beauty of the Chinese dream, or the Zhongguomeng, which is on billboards plastered all over the country, is that you can make the Chinese dream whatever you want. You live in the north, south, east, west, whatever you aspire to, that can be part of the Chinese dream. It's a little bit like the old Wild West American frontier, whereas you can make whatever life you want. Get out there and dream big and work hard, and you can go places. So if you're sitting in Hong Kong, although your dream might be a little bit dashed today in terms of the principles of democracy and universal suffrage, I'm sure that some are still keeping the dream alive that at some point there will be recognition that Hong Kong is a very, very special place and will benefit enormously by maintaining those individual characteristics.
So you think buy some time right now, show some flexibility, maybe a technocratic solution that Xi Jinping actually, even if he overplayed it to begin with, may be a little smarter in this right now than a lot of observers think?
He can't afford to make a bad decision on Hong Kong. Given how the anti-corruption campaign is playing out, given the long knives that will lie in wait for him, given the economic importance even today of Hong Kong and how the global marketplace will perceive the choices that that he will make, all of that is registering loud and clear. I have no doubt about it in Zhongnanhai in Beijing. So as he's going to have to thread the needle, and it won't be an easy thing to do, but the stakes for him politically are extremely high.
So take it internationally for a second. You talked about the fact that U.S. corporations and others are already rethinking whether or not Hong Kong is the place they want to be long term. Of course, we're also seeing a lot of American corporations with a lot of concerns about whether mainland China is someplace they want to be as aggressively long term. The AmCham report that just came out. Is China becoming so big at this point and so different that you expect to see more conflict and confrontation with the United States?
Well, anytime you have a trading relationship that exceeds $500 billion per year, going on $1 trillion per year, which will make it the largest economic relationship the world has ever known, you're going to have some tricky issues. You're going to have trade disputes. Some of them are going to look downright unresolvable, and they're going to carry with them a lot of emotion and a lot of passion. I mean, for heaven's sake, you know, we've had a longstanding relationship with the EU, but I remember some pretty difficult cases there with respect to Airbus subsidies and even bananas not so long ago that became that became pretty difficult. So as the relationship with China grows and as it increases in size and complexity, clearly we're going to have more trade complaints and disputes. I think that's a given. But important in all of this is how Xi Jinping chooses to steer his reform package going forward, which we're going to know a lot more about in the next week or two with the fourth plenum, which will then build on the third plenum of last November of the 18th Party Congress, which really did spell out, you know, the principles of fiscal and financial reform, how to deal with things like urbanization, the hundreds of millions of people who are moving from the central part of the country into the city centers, how you deal with things like reform of the state-owned enterprises, of which there are 110 key companies, of which there are five mega companies. They must be reformed in terms of the rules of the road in order for the broader economic reform measures to ever have any chance of being implemented. So the answer to a lot of this, where the economic relationship with not only the U.S. but the rest of the world goes, is really tied up in these reform measures. And if I were a gambling person, which I am, I guess, I would say that we have another 2 to 3 years before the 19th Party Congress, where Xi Jinping will continue consolidating his power base, which is already today substantial. And then between the 19th Party Congress and 2022, which will be the 20th Party Congress, I suspect he's going to be full-time focused on the economic reforms, many of which are downright audacious and aspirational. And I suspect we'll look back 7, 8 years down the road and see that Xi Jinping had an impact on China with respect to economic reform, much like Deng Xiaoping did in the late 1970s when he swung open the doors, certainly to the United States, for purposes of trade and investment.
So if we look at Xi Jinping's rule so far, economic transformation, but also very much consolidation of power, do you view what we've seen so far in Hong Kong as really fundamentally about the latter? And do you really believe at the end of the day that he's able to back away from it, if that's what's required in the situation?
Yeah. Yeah, so this is a little taste, I think, of what lies ahead over the next 10, 20, 30 years in other traditional Chinese cities. So Hong Kong, being a special autonomous region in SAR, is a little different in terms of its more recent history and a lot of its influences. But with a new generation emerging in China, networked, accessing the outside world, 200, soon 300,000 students studying in the United States, hundreds of thousands in other Western countries, the pull toward greater openness, transparency, and fundamental democratic principles, I think, will grow more and more intense. So as Xi Jinping sits back and analyzes Hong Kong, I think he's probably thinking to himself, how I address and answer Hong Kong will in large measure probably have some connection with how I address similar circumstances in the next 10 years of his leadership.
And the way he's addressed it, not only on the international stage, but also domestically. You look at some of the statements that have been made by Chinese state media, sound a little more hardline in terms of calling for the police forces to respond very quickly and the Hong Kong population to support it. Certainly, if you're in China today, you're getting a very specific and very limited view of what's happening on the ground in Hong Kong. Is that a mistake? Does he need to back away from that, especially if compromise is where we have to go here?
Compromise will have to be part of it, but then you have to get back to his leadership model. So he's established himself not as a group participant with the standing committee, whereby you arrive at a conclusion after ruminating on options and compromising and giving and taking, which is the traditional Chinese leadership model, at least under the last two leaders. He has singularly positioned himself in the model of Mao and in the model of Deng Xiaoping, where this is about Xi Jinping. He's the singular player in all of this. And he'll have to figure out where to compromise and how to compromise, and indeed how to deal with some of these difficult and thorny issues, because he's just on the leading edge of clearly what will be a whole lot more. And you got to remember the story of Hong Kong is not just limited to Hong Kong and the non-Chinese countries in the Asia-Pacific region, but in every major hotel and every major bookstore and drugstore where they have newspapers. Increasingly, you've got Western newspapers that are available. They try to gazette them from time to time. But listen, getting access to the outside world is not so difficult in China. You've got to do a little work to jump the Great Firewall, but that's easily done. And there's a whole lot more information circulating there about the rest of the world than people might imagine.
John Huntsman, thank you very much for joining me this evening.
Thank you, Ian.
We continue our coverage of the unrest in Hong Kong with Michael Green. He joins us from Washington. Michael is the Senior Vice President for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'm pleased to have him on this program. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you.
So you just heard some of my conversation with John Huntsman. Let me ask you, where do you think Xi Jinping is right now? It seems that we're poised on a precipice. Do you believe that we can find flexibility?
Well, I thought that John Huntsman laid out precisely how Xi Jinping should think about Hong Kong, what's at stake for his reputation, his economy. And I thought John made a compelling case I'd agree with, that we should aim for that kind of flexibility and compromise. I'm not sure we'll get it, though, at least judging from recent history. Xi clearly is the decision maker. He's consolidated power around himself, like Deng, like Mao, in ways we haven't seen in some time in China. But if you look at the other cases that sort of parallel this, the Uyghur unrest in Xinjiang, the Tibetans, the South China Sea confrontations with the Philippines and Vietnam, and East China Sea with China, and also how under Xi, China has cracked down on international NGOs and civil society, the pattern is that Xi doesn't back down, that he is showing a strong fist everywhere. And it may be this is temporary because he has an ambitious reform agenda, but it may also be a reflection of what some Chinese say, which is he talks like Deng, but he hits like Mao. So I'm not convinced he'll exhibit flexibility, but we should try to explore that and push exactly the logic that John Huntsman described earlier.
I mean, since the crisis with Hong Kong has started, is there reason to believe that he has any ability or willingness to show flexibility? Is that too positive a shade?
So I think that Xi Jinping has approached this like a Marxist, and he's a Marxist as an intellectual. He studies dialectic materialism, the forces of history, which argue that material factors, i.e. wealth creation, trump everything else. So the Chinese calculus everywhere in Tibet and Xinjiang with neighboring states, and especially in Hong Kong, is that if we make you rich, you'll be happy, and that will be the end of it. I think this is a kind of turning point in how the leadership in Zhuhai look at Hong Kong, because it's clear that money can't buy you love, that development in Hong Kong, or even the fear of economic damage in Hong Kong is not enough to detour these protesters from demanding what they were promised in 2007, which is universal suffrage. So this is a new world, I suspect, that sort of betrays the logic of Chinese domestic politics and foreign policy that Xi has championed. At the same time, this is not like July 1st, 2003, when there were protests, large protests, against China's anti-subversion law. And in that case, the executive in Hong Kong backed off. He compromised. In this case, though, it's a white paper out of Beijing. So much harder to find a face-saving compromise, because now it's all on Xi Jinping himself. There's no middleman who made this declaration who can now, you know, take the hit, as C.H. Tung did in 2003, and sort of back away and preserve face for Beijing. And the final point on this, and a reason why I think this is not going to go away, is that the protesters are extremely well organized. You know, they have this app called Fire Chat, which is Bluetooth technology, largely impervious to the great firewall, the great Chinese wall on the internet. They are determined.
What do you think the response needs to be from the United States now? And where does it need to go going forward?
So I thought the administration, the White House statement was good. It was very much on point. It took a little while, but what they put out yesterday and today reconfirmed our support for universal suffrage in Hong Kong and our support for the aspirations of the people protesting. The White House didn't say we support exactly their demands, because there is, it's a large